Okay. So today we're going to really get into talking about the generalized formalism. Just going to finish off some little bits about the linear algebra stuff I was doing last time. And then we're going to look at density operators, I'm sure you've seen before, but in a slightly different way. And I'll at least start talking about completely positive trace preserving maps by the end. Okay, so if you remember last time, we convinced ourselves that the linear operators from one Hilbert space to another is just a Hilbert space. We derived that it had an inner product. You could think of it as the tensor product of the dual of the input space with the output space. Since it's a Hilbert space, it's going to have orthonormal bases, and it will have more than one different orthonormal basis, right? So far, we've been working with these vectors here, which are an orthonormal basis. They're like the standard orthonormal basis. So if we want, we can consider consider this vector space, HA dagger tensor HB. We can consider that to be a space of kets, if we like, and its dual space, the linear operators from B to A, to be a space of bras, if you like, right? So here I'm just saying, okay, I'm going to think of this kind of thing as a ket. Okay, so then you can see that this is an orthonormal basis because if you take the inner product of one of these things with its dual, I have to take this thing, I have to dualize it. Then when I convert this ket into a bra, it'll act on here. When I convert this bra into a ket, it'll act on this term, and those will just give me the two delta functions, right? So that those vectors or those operators are orthonormal. So clearly from this, you can see that as a vector space, the set of linear operators from HA to HB has dimension DA tensor DB because there are as many Ks as there are dimensions of A and as many Js as there are dimensions of B. Okay, so that's the standard basis, but there are many other operational bases. So if you remember, the inner product between two operators could be written as trace of the dagger of one operator times the other operator, okay, like this. Okay, so if we consider, for example, just the linear operators on a two-dimensional Hilbert space, say from a two-dimensional Hilbert space to a two-dimensional Hilbert space, those are 2 by 2 matrices, and we can write down the three Pauli operators and the identity operator, which I'm going to call sigma zero. Now these operators are self-adjoint, right? So if I take the trace of one of these operators with another one, I don't have to take the dagger's going to act trivially. But if I square one of these operators and then take the trace, so if I square one of these operators, I get the identity. That's true for all of these operators. And the trace of the identity is 2, right? So if I want these to be orthonormal, if I want their inner product to be a delta function, I have to renormalize them. If I put in a factor of 1 over square root of 2, then when I take a trace of a pair of these, I'll get a factor of a half, so I'll get an inner product of 1 when I inner product with itself. So then you see that this is an orthonormal basis where these j, k indices now run from 0 to 3, so because we have a four-dimensional space. Okay, so because that's a basis, consequently, every operator on a qubit can be written in terms of this basis, right? So you can write it in terms of components, which you'll get by taking the inner product with the Pauli matrices. You get a factor of a half here because really the basis operators are these guys with an extra factor 1 over root 2. Okay, so if I want to write it in terms of these matrices, I'm going to get a factor of a half. Okay, so that's just to show that that's another example of an operator basis. Okay, so now what we're going to do is look at a subspace of the set of linear operators. So If your input and output spaces are the same, so you're looking at the linear operators on HA from HA to HA, then you can have the definition of the adjoint, and so you can have self-adjoint operators. Okay, so here's an operator, here's its adjoint. So we just take the transpose, I've just transposed these indices here and taken the complex conjugate. Because these spaces are the same, I can ask whether these two operators are the same as each other. Okay, and if they are, that's what we mean by a self-adjoint operator. Now, the self-adjoint operators, set of self-adjoint operators, is also a Hilbert space, but it's a Hilbert space over the real numbers. So the linear operators in general are a Hilbert space over the complex numbers. This one is self-adjoint operators are a Hilbert space over the real numbers. Okay, so so here's how you can see that. So if you have two self-adjoint operators and you take a combination of them with real coefficients, then when I dagger it, I'll still get a self-adjoint operator. So any linear combination of self-adjoints with real values is self-adjoint. So it's closed under taking linear combinations. It's a vector space. Now you can also show that the Hilbert-Schmidt inner product here is always going to give you a real number. It's sort of easier to do that once you have the idea of bases for this space. Okay, so now what's the dimension of this space? It turns out that it's the same as the dimension of the linear operators from A to B in general. But remember, this is a real vector space, and that's a complex vector space. So there are still fewer parameters here, okay? Because we're only talking about the dimension of a real vector space. So there's twice as many parameters in the complex vector space. So how can you see that? So if you have a self-adjoint operator and you write it in a matrix form, it'll be a square matrix. Along the diagonal, you have real entries, okay? So that means that for every element of the diagonal, there's one parameter you need to specify. So you get d real parameters from the diagonal. And from the off diagonals, you get d minus one times d. Why is that? Well, first of all, once I specify the upper diagonal entries, these ones are completely specified. So I only have to count how many parameters there are up here. These guys will be the complex conjugates. Okay, so how many entries are there here? Well, it's just going to be the triangle numbers, right? So, because in the corner I'll have one, here I'll have two, then in the next row I'll have three, et cetera, all the way up to d minus one. So I've got to take the sum of all of those. So you will get, so the triangle numbers, you can calculate, it's just an arithmetic progression. There are d minus one times d over two. Entries on this off diagonal. But I have to double that because these are complex numbers. They have a real part and an imaginary part. So I get this many parameters, and when I sum that's just d squared. So the dimension of this vector space is the same as the full set of linear operators, only it's a real vector space. So if that itself is an inner product space, then there ought to be a set of basis operators that are themselves self-adjoint, right? I ought to be able to find a basis that lives in the same space that is actually in the vector space itself. Okay, so the standard basis that we use here isn't self-adjoint. When I take the adjoint of that, I'll get kj instead of jk. But we've already seen one example of a self-adjoint basis, which was the case for C2, just the Pauli operators. Those are all self-adjoint. Okay, so that's an example. There are many bases that you can construct, but one way of constructing a basis is to just take these things and make them into self-adjoint operators by adding the adjoints and then doing the same thing with plus or minus I, right? So this here is really sort of a generalization of this matrix and a generalization of this matrix. But you have to be a bit careful with counting how many of these there are, right? Because when I look at, for example, the case J is equal to K, then basically there's only then both of these two things are the same, right? You have to count how many of these things are actually different. Okay, I'm not going to go into that, but when you do, you see that there are actually d squared operators like this. So that's just to say that self-adjoint bases exist, and you can easily show that the trace of any of these against any other one that's different will give you zero. Any questions about that? Okay. The other thing is that self-adjoint operators are their own duals, right? So when we're in a general vector space, a dual vector is different vector, so it lives in a different vector space, but it's generally different from the original vector. So because the set of self-adjoint operators is a subset of the linear operators, its dual space won't be the whole, all of these operators. So because it's a real Hilbert space, what we mean by the dual space is the set of linear functionals from self-adjoint operators to the real numbers, not to the complex numbers. However, it's still a Hilbert space, and so it has an inner product. So what we showed last time is that when you have a Hilbert space, there's an isomorphism between the vector space and its dual, right? So let's see what that isomorphism looks like. So if you write a vector or a self-adjoint operator in terms of some self-adjoint basis, we've shown that those exist, it'll have real coefficients here. And then when I dualize means taking the dual vector means taking the dagger. The dagger of this operator, well, all of these are self-adjoint, so it's just the same thing, okay? So unlike the general case, in this particular space, vectors are their own dual vectors. There's another space which is worth considering, which is you can consider an algebra of a set of operators that commute. So the algebra of a set of commuting operators. Okay, so let's consider basically a maximal set of commuting operators. That means, at least in finite dimensions, very straightforwardly, the set of all operators that happen to be diagonal in a common basis. That's also a Hilbert space, generally over the complex numbers. Okay, so suppose this is the diagonalizing basis, then all operators can be written like this, and it's very easy to see that if I take linear combinations of such operators, I still have such an operator. Okay, so now again, this is a restriction of the full space of linear operators, so your inner product will be inherited from that, and it's very easy to see that these basis vectors here, JJ, those are an operator basis for this particular space, and therefore the dimension of this is D. Okay, so in general, these numbers here can be complex if we're just considering a set of commuting operators, but again, we can restrict attention to the self-adjoint ones, which mean that these eigenvalues all have to be real, and then this is going to be, a real Hilbert space, and I'm going to call this C of HA. It's kind of the set of classical observables, right? So you can consider a set of commuting operators as a model for a set of classical observables, which all commute with one another. And again, same kind of reason last time as in the previous slide, these operators are their own dual vectors. Okay, any questions about that? Okay, good. So now I just want to briefly remind you of this idea I introduced in lecture one about there being two churches of quantum theory. Okay, so we have the church of the larger Hilbert space and the church of the smaller Hilbert space. The idea of the church of the larger Hilbert space is that we focus on the idea that there's a pure state, potentially of the entire universe, that evolves unitarily, and that's it. And the idea is that everything about quantum theory ought to be derivable from the idea of that quantum state evolving unitarily. Today, in my Church of the Larger Hilbert Space considerations, I will also allow myself to do projective measurements on that state, and I'll just sort of take that as a primitive. If you really believe in this Church of the Larger Hilbert Space, you ought to derive projective measurement entirely from Schrödinger evolution in some way, and that we will discuss when we talk about the Everett many worlds interpretation. But for today, I'm just gonna allow myself that. In the Church of the Smaller Hilbert Space point of view, we want to regard instead quantum theory as the only way of having a consistent probability theory for quantum observables, for the set of self-adjoint operators. So the point is that you can derive the entire generalized formalism from these two points of view separately, and they give you the same answers. Okay, so let's start with... what's the difference between them? Well, I mean, you'll see more as we go on. I mean, you probably already know the derivations I'm gonna do here. You've probably seen something like it before, but I just want to sort of cleanly separate what belongs with what. So let's talk about density operators. So let's start by talking about the Church of the Larger Hilbert Space type of view. So according to the Larger Church, entire universe is always in a pure state vector. So if we are using any other mathematical object to describe the state of a quantum system, it must be because we're only looking at a subsystem of it, right? Otherwise, there would be a pure state. What we imagine is that there's some system S that we're interested in and its environment, which contains enough of the universe to guarantee that we're in a pure state. Okay, so then you will have a vector in this tensor product state, or in our other notations, this kind of abstract index object, or this kind of diagram, right? Okay, so now what we suppose is that we're only interested in system S. So we're gonna perform measurements and we're interested in what's gonna happen. But we're not going to look at the environment system, only the system itself. Okay, so let's suppose we make a projective measurement on the system, and then the probability of getting an outcome, you know, suppose this is one of the projectors, then we just use the usual Born rule. We're sandwiching the projector, we're not doing anything to the environment, so that just gets an identity operator. We're sandwiching that whole projector between the state, and in abstract index notation, that's gonna look like this. You're contracting the system index of the projector with the system index of psi and psi dagger. And similarly, you're gonna have a diagram like this. The environmental degrees of freedom don't touch the projector, they just go straight through. Okay. Does the system include the measurement apparatus? So what I'm doing here, what I said is, for the purposes of this lecture, I'm just gonna allow myself to do projective measurements for free, not bother considering how they arise. And then later on in the course, we'll talk about how you derive them from a unitary picture. So the aspect of the Church of the Larger Hilbert Space that's going on here is really the idea that aside from that, everything is unitary and pure states. Okay, so now if you look at this object, you can see that there's a contraction of the environment indices, which you could do before you do the things to do with the system indices, right? So I can just define this object here, which is just the contraction over the environment indices, right? So this has two system indices, and then if I contract this object with the projector, that'll give me my probability. So because this has just system indices, one upper and one lower, then this lives in the space HS tensor its dagger, right? So it's the tensor product of a Hilbert space with its dual, which is the same thing as the linear operators on that Hilbert space, right? Or it's also the same thing as the dual of that, right? So when the input and output spaces are the same space, then when I dualize, I go from HA maps to HB to HB maps to HA. But if HA and HB are the same, then those are the same space, right? So you can think of this operator either as an operator, or you can think of it as what I called a duperator. They're the same thing, mathematically exactly the same thing, but an operator, we usually think of something that acts on a vector and gives you another vector, whereas a duperator, we're conceptually thinking of it as an object that takes in an operator and gives us, spits out a number. So a dual, the dual of an operator. So it's normal practice to call this object the density operator, although when you use it in calculations, you use it as a duperator, right? So you use it to assign probabilities to a, or expectation values to observables. So you use it as a map from observables to numbers, right? Which you really should call it the density duperator, but that's, it's the same thing. All right. So in diagrams, here's what's going on. This object we've defined is just the contraction over the environment index. That's what I mean by this object. I tend to like to write operators as boxes, right, that don't have funny things like this. So if I'm thinking of something as an operator, I tend to write it like this. But remember, the topology, topology of these diagrams doesn't really matter. What matters is whether the lines are coming out of upward or downward-oriented surfaces. So I can write this thing like this, or I can write it like that. It's the same thing, bearing in mind that when I transform this to this, this line is becomes this one. Okay, they're both S lines, but which one's which? So in Dirac notation, going back to Dirac notation, we write the density operator, or the, we write the density operator like this, the contraction over E, we write it as a trace over E. Okay, so we trace just over the, this is a partial inner product just over E here, and that's how we define this operation that we normally call the partial trace over E. So in Dirac language, this density operator is a partial trace over the projector onto the pure state. So any questions about that? All good? Good. All right. So that's how we derive the density operator. Question is, what kind of operators can be density operators now? So you probably know they're positive operators. So I'm just gonna tell you some things about positive operators. You may know these things already, but just make sure everybody knows, okay? So what do we mean by a positive operator? So if we have an operator, then what we mean by positive, mathematicians would call this semi-positive, but I don't want to keep writing semi everywhere. So if I sandwich this operator between a bra and a ket, the same bra and a ket, if that's always a positive number, then that's what we mean by a positive operator. That's the definition. And then there's a theorem which says that an operator is positive if and only if it's a self-adjoint operator. Once it's self-adjoint, we know that it's diagonalizable with real eigenvalues. And then in addition, those eigenvalues have to be positive, greater than or equal to zero. Okay, so how do you prove it? Well, so first of all, let's prove that a positive operator must be self-adjoint. So the way you do this is we're going to take a psi that can be written in terms of two vectors like this with an I here. And we're also going to take a psi which can be written as the same vectors with a minus different sign here. Okay, so then what we're going to do is just plug this into this equation. And then here, for this one, you'll get this with a minus I here and a plus I here. And here, you'll get the same thing, but you'll get a plus I here and a minus I here. Okay, so then what we're going to do is subtract these two equations. So this these two will cancel, these two terms will cancel, and I'll just be left with basically 2 times this is greater than or equal to 0. So if I divide that by 2i, then I'll end up with this equation, and that's just the definition of what a self-adjoint operator is. Okay? So positivity implies self-adjoint. So if you have a self-adjoint operator, then you know it has real eigenvalues. So here's one of its eigenvectors, and here's the corresponding eigenvalue. Now we can apply the positivity condition to the eigenvector, right? So it's because this holds for all vectors, it in particular holds for the eigenvector. So that means that when I take the inner product of this equation with phi, inner product of phi with itself is 1. So this just says that the lambda is greater than or equal to 0. So lambda's positive. Okay, so conversely, if you have a self-adjoint operator with positive eigenvalues, and then you take, sandwich it between any psi and any other psi, and you'll get this. You'll get this thing here is just the mod squared of the inner product of psi j and psi, like this. So everything here is positive. So these eigenvalues are positive. These are mod squared, so they're positive. So it's the sum of a bunch of positive things. So this will be positive. Okay, so that proves that equivalence. Okay, so does everybody follow that, by the way? All very easy? Hope so. All right, so there's another decomposition of positive operators that's useful. If we have an operator that's positive, then an operator is positive if and only if it can be written as n dagger n for some other operator n, right? This operator n doesn't have to be positive, and it doesn't even have to have the same input or an output space, right? So it can be an operator from HA to some other Hilbert space HB, but when I multiply it with its dual, right, I'll get the B, the output here will be B and the input here will be B, right? So that product will be just an operator on HA. Okay, so how do we prove this? Well, let's say, suppose M can be written like this. Then we sandwich M between psi's, and that will give us this form. But this is just the inner product of a vector with itself. Okay, this thing here is the dual of this thing. Okay, so we know that the inner product of vector with itself from the properties of the inner product is positive. That's one of the defining properties of an inner product. It's just the norm of this vector. Okay, so conversely, suppose M is a positive operator, then we know from the previous theorem that it can be written as self-adjoint and has positive eigenvalues, like this. So then I can define an operator which is the square root of this operator. It just means take the square roots of these eigenvalues. This operator is self-adjoint, so it's equal to its own dagger, right? So if I define n to be this operator, then n dagger n is just this operator squared, so it just gives me m back, okay? So you can always write a positive operator like that. All right. So now let's show that density operators are positive. Oh, okay, I'm gonna show that they have unit trace first, okay? So we know that this thing is a state vector, the one that we started with. It's a normalized state, so when I take the inner product with its dual, I should get 1, okay? So this object here is just 1. On the other hand, the trace of the density operator, which I get by contracting both of the indices of the density operator, is just this. Right, same thing, because to define rho, I contracted the environment indices, and now I'm contracting the other indices. So if this state is normalized, then this density operator has trace 1. The other thing we can do, Well, this is how we write the density operator in abstract index notation, just to have a contraction on the E indices. Right, let me go back to the definition of the density operator. So here we define the density operator as the contraction of a vector on the tensor product of two ket spaces and a vector on the tensor product of two dual spaces. But what I can do is I can, if I raise this index and lower this index, they'll still give me the same thing. Then I'll have something which is the product of two operators. Let's see. Okay, so let me show you that this is true. So this is the definition of the density operator here, but I can raise and lower indices, right? So if I put in one of these delta things here, that will lower the environment index, and here I can raise the environment index. Now what you see is that these two deltas have a common index here, so I can contract them. I can contract over that index, and then I'll just get this. And this is just basically the identity operator. But now I can do another contraction. I can contract this index with this index. That's going to give me an NE down here, right? So this is now the same thing. It's a product of two operators now. And we're contracting over the environment index. In diagrams, this is kind of cool. There's a lot of category theory behind this, which I'm not going into, but basically you can sort of treat these wires like string, just like an elastic band, right? You can just sort of move it around as long as you keep the topology the same. So if I move this box to the bottom and this one to the top, then the contraction is like this. And if you remember, this guy was one of those delta tensors, and this guy is one of those delta tensors. That's what those curved lines mean. Okay? So this is literally this contraction here. And then by definition, if I put this in a box here, that's what I mean by this picture. Okay. So it's actually very easy to see what's going on in pictures in that case. Okay, so now let's look at this. This thing, remember, the product of two operators is the same thing as the partial inner product over one of the indices, this one, right? So this shows that this density operator is indeed of this form, n dagger n, where here n is this operator, so it's psi dagger, and it's in the space that maps HS, right? We have a dual index on S, and it goes to a vector index on E, so that's the linear operators from HS to HG. Right, so that shows from the previous theorem that the density operator is a positive operator indeed. So in summary, what we've shown is that density operators have to be positive, and they have to have trace 1. And now we have another question. Can any positive trace 1 operator arise from tracing out, from ignoring the environment for some global pure state? And the answer is yes. Okay. So here's how it works. So remember this delta. The delta state, so this guy means this. Right. Oops. Okay. So here I'm using just for convenience, I'm using two different system index. I'm using S and S prime. They're the same Hilbert space, right? So S and S prime have the same dimension. Now, if I take a density operator, a positive trace one operator, and act with rho to the half, Then what do I get? Well, in well, okay, so looks like I've skipped a step here. So I'm going to get, yeah, I've written this wrong. So it should be rho to the half. This is an operator. And then I've written the wrong delta here. This is the vector, so it should be LS KS, like that. Now, if I do that, that defines a vector because it will pull up this index. So this will be psi rho, what I'm defining as psi rho JS KS. Okay, so then you in principle have to show that that vector is normalized. I haven't written out the calculation, but it's fairly clear that when you contract this with its dual, this thing is self-adjoint, so it's its own dual. You'll get two factors of rho to the half, and then you end up getting that the inner product of this thing with itself is just trace of rho, which we know is one.
So the environment that we need to for purification
So,
does not have to be larger than the
right, so that
vector.
also shows that that we don't need an environment that's larger than the dimension of the system, okay, to purify. Okay, so that shows that you can get any density operator that way. Any question about that? I just made a mistake here. All right. Okay, so now let's talk about the search of the smaller Hilbert space picture. Okay, so in that picture, you don't care about the pure states of the environment and things like that. All you care about is that whatever I want to call a quantum state should be any possible consistent way that I can assign probabilities to the outcomes of observables. So any consistent way of doing that at all should be a valid quantum state. Okay, so I mean, even classically, you can view a probability distribution as a function that assigns expectation values to random variables, classically. Okay, in the quantum case, we can view a quantum state, whatever quantum state should be, as a functional that should assign expectation values to observables. Okay, so there's going to be some map from the self-adjoint operators to the real numbers. If you then apply, like projectional operators are specific examples of self-adjoint operators, and a projection operator ought to receive a probability. So in the special case where we're applying this function to a projector, you should end up with a probability at the end. Now, classically, one thing that expectation values obey is linearity, right? So if these are two random variables and I take the expectation value of the linear combination, I just get this. Okay, so for now, although I will remove it later, for now, let's suppose this is true for the self-adjoint operators, right? So let's suppose that the expectation value of the linear combination of alpha n plus beta n should be the linear combination of expectation values. This assumption is a little bit problematic what it really means operationally, but at least in order to simplify the derivation, since we don't have infinite time, we'll do it that way. Okay, so a linear functional from the self-adjoint operators to R is just the very definition of the dual space, right? So in this sense, rho, it must be a duperator on the self-adjoint operators. However, we already saw that the self-adjoint operators are self-dual, so you're going to get for free from this derivation that rho has to be a self-adjoint operator. That was very easy, right? So it's going to be, if we take this operator, we're going to have to act on it with a dual vector. So we're going to get for free that we have this trace formula where this thing is a self-adjoint operator. Okay, so now we're going to also get positivity very easily, right? Because we demand that projectors represent measurement outcomes, they have to be assigned probabilities. Right? So if I use a particular example of a projection operator, then that should be positive. So now let's look at the particular example of a one-dimensional projector. So a projector onto, yes?
So what you're saying is if I have a quantum state, that I also must have like an actual density operator.
What I'm saying is, what I'm saying at the moment is that any linear functional from self-adjoint operators to real numbers is a self-adjoint operator that acts like this.
And that's okay. Also true for infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces.
That's okay. It's also true for infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces. When you get into quantum field theory and stuff like that, then that actually does break down, because in quantum field theory, you know, the set of linear functionals on the algebra of observables, which may have infinite degrees of freedom, isn't always an operator. It is if you impose certain other restrictions. Okay, but this is a bit beyond the scope of where we're going here. There you really have to think of it as a duperator, because there is really that this kind of correspondence between the observables and the dual space breaks down slightly. So now what I want to say is let's take a projector onto a one-dimensional projector, so a projector onto some state psi. Then this equation becomes this, which is just this, right? So it just says, okay, if this has to be true for all psi, that means that the operator has to be positive. So now we derived positivity, and there's only one more property, which is that it should have trace one, right? So what we want is that we have a well-defined probability distribution. So if we have a projective measurement, so a set of orthogonal projectors that sum to the identity, then they must receive probabilities that sum to one, because they represent the outcomes of the same measurement, right? So when we sum the probabilities of all the outcomes, we need to get one. Okay, so those are the probabilities we've just derived, and I can take this sum inside. The projectors sum to the identity, so that's just the trace of the density operator. So we've shown that that has to equal trace one. Okay, so just by assuming that we must have a linear way of assigning expectation values to self-adjoint operators that gives well-defined probabilities, we derive the properties of the density operator that's positive and trace one. Now remember I introduced this space of commuting observables. So if you applied exactly the same reasoning to a vector space of commuting self-adjoint operators, a classical set of observables, then that space is again its own dual space, and you would get from the same reasoning that the set of possible density operators on that space must look like this, where because these guys are all diagonal on the same basis, all of these guys commute and are diagonal in the same basis. Okay, so effectively, in that case, you just get classical probability distributions which are on the diagonal of the density operator. That diagonal is the same basis for all of them. Okay, so really, you can really think of it like this, and this is really the Church of the Smaller Hilbert space point of view. A classical theory has this kind of set of observables, and you get classical probability over it when you apply it. And when you generalize to the non-commutative set, you just get quantum theory. Okay, so that's really the point of view. It's a generalization of probability theory. Okay, but you've seen that those two pictures get you to exactly the same place. However, let me briefly talk about this linearity condition. So I started from, well, I had alphas and betas, but that's irrelevant. If I take the sum of two operators, then the expectation value should sum like this. I needed that in order to argue that rho should live in the dual space, right? Because it needs to be a vector space. And so I need that linearity to be in the dual space. This isn't really operationally meaningful. So classically, what you would mean by this is, well, one way of measuring the observable m plus n classically is to measure both m and n, and then once I've got the result, sum them, right? But quantum mechanically, if these two operators don't commute, then there's no experiment in which I can measure both m and n. So there's no real reason why I should necessarily expect that to hold. Okay. Fortunately, you can remove that assumption by proving a much harder theorem, which is called Gleason's theorem. It comes from was proved in the 1950s by Andrew Gleason. There's a caveat to it, which is that it only works for Hilbert space dimension greater than or equal to 3. In quantum foundations, things only working for Hilbert space dimension greater than or equal to 3 is something that happens often. And there's a good reason for that, which I'll tell you about in a minute. So what we want to do, what we do here is we just forget about the self-adjoint operators. Projectors represent measurement outcomes. So what I need to do is assign probabilities to projectors. Okay? So every projector should, by this function, get assigned some positive number. If the projectors are orthogonal, then that means they can exist as the outcomes of some measurement together. So then their probabilities should add. And finally, the probability assigned to the identity operator, which is the sum of any projective measurement, of the projectors in any projective measurement, should be 1. So these conditions are all you need to guarantee that every projective measurement will get assigned a valid probability. So the conclusion of Gleason's theorem is that this function must always be trace of rho pi for some density operator. Okay, so that's an important result, but this is unfortunately would take me probably 2 lectures to prove it. So
does rho depend only on f or also on pi?
Rho is independent of pi. So f is a function from pi's to the real numbers. Now, there is an assumption in here, built in here, which is kind of implicit, which is that the same projection operator can occur in different measurements, right? So if I have a basis that consists of these 3 vectors, then I can have another basis where I keep this vector fixed and have 2 other vectors in the orthogonal plane, right? And since this is a function on projection operators, then I'm saying that the probability that you get in this measurement must be the same as the probability that this one gets in the other measurement. That assumption is sometimes called non-contextuality. So that there is an assumption there, and you can worry about it. But assuming that you think that projectors are in some sense the thing that represent outcomes, that represent physically meaningful outcomes, this is how you can derive it. This is also the reason why it only works for dimension greater than or equal to 3. So in 2 dimensions, in a 2-dimensional Hilbert space, every vector has a unique, up to global phase, vector orthogonal to it. So there are no commonalities between the projectors in different measurements. Okay. So there's no way of piecing together a function like this to imply that it must be a density operator. You could assign arbitrary probabilities to arbitrary probability distributions to every measurement, and that would satisfy these assumptions in 2 dimensions. Any questions about that? Okay.
Gleason's theorem assumes contextuality.
Assumes non-contextuality of probability assignments. There's a difference between non-contextuality of probability assignments and non-contextuality of an underlying hidden variable theory. Quantum mechanics obeys the first. The probability assignments in quantum mechanics are non-contextual in this sense, but it doesn't obey the second, as we'll discuss next week.
So what exactly is the difference between what you're assuming here and what Cochen and Specker disproved?
Okay, you can prove the Cochen-Specker theorem starting from this theorem. John Bell did it.
Yeah, okay, but like
but
Cochin and Specker say that contextuality is true. So
you're
working
and Specker,
with two different definitions
and
of
Specker,
contextuality.
Further impose on this function that it should give the value at 0 or 1 to every projector. Right, so they're looking at, you might call it hidden variable theories, where every observable has a definite outcome. Okay, so here we're allowing F to assign a probability. In the Cochin-Specker theorem, it has to assign the value 0 or 1 to every projector. Right, you can prove from here that you can't do that, because you know that every density operator, every quantum state, assigns a probability that's not 0 or 1 to some observable, right? So if I take a pure state, for instance, and I take some observable that it's not an eigenstate of, then it gets assigned probabilities that are not 0 or 1. We know from Gleason's theorem that the only functions that are non-contextual in this sense are those. So you know that there are actually no functions that assign values 0 and 1 to every observable and also obey these assumptions. So Gleason's theorem implies the Cochin-Specker theorem that was pointed out by John Bell in the 1960s. But, the point of the Cochin-Specker theorem is that you can get the same conclusion without having to assume, without having to do such a complicated construction involving considering every possible projector. All right. Okay, so let's consider the case of qubits. So we've already seen that a qubit density, that any qubit operator can be written in terms of the Pauli, based on Pauli operators like this. Now we know that density operators must have positive eigenvalues and trace equal to 1. The only one of these operators that has a non-zero trace is the identity operator. All of these other three are traceless. So trace 1 just means that the component here has to have trace 1. So half the identity has trace 1. So that means that there's never a M0 is always 1. And then you can prove by computing the eigenvalues of this that you have positive eigenvalues if and only if this thing is, these three remaining components are a unit vector. And it will equal 1 for a pure state. So that means that the density operators geometrically for a qubit are the points inside the unit ball, and the pure states, the ones that are state vectors, are the points on the surface. Right? So this is what's called the Bloch sphere representation. Just to note that even if you go to dimension 3, you don't get anything near as simple a picture. You get quite a horrible looking state space. So the unit ball is only for two-dimensional states. But it's actually, it's quite a nice geometric representation and allows you to prove a lot of things geometrically. Okay, 5 or so minutes left. So are there any questions about density operators before I move on? Okay, so I'm not going to get through very much of this, but let's make a start on it. Okay, so the next thing we want to look at is dynamics. And let's take the Church of the Larger Hilbert space view. So the dynamics of an isolated system, a system which isn't interacting with its environment, is unitary. But in general, a system might interact with the rest of the universe. And the question is, how do we keep track of the density operator of the system on its own? So according to the Church of the Larger Hilbert space, the system and environment generally start in a possibly entangled pure state. I'm calling the environment system R here for reference system, which you'll see why in a minute. Now, the description of dynamics to be given here, strictly speaking, only works if the system is interacting with a part of the environment that it isn't initially correlated with. Actually, this isn't quite true. You can generalize it slightly, but the way it's usually presented, that's the way we do it. So that means, okay, so although the system is initially correlated with its environment, it's only going to interact with some other system that it's in a product, that happens to be in a product state with. Okay, so we have this initial kind of state, and then there's a unit tree which just interacts the system with this environmental degree of freedom. So the output state, which I'm calling psi tilde of the three systems, may be now entangled between all three systems, is going to be given by this. So in the diagrammatic notation, we have our system, we have the environment that it interacts with, we have the environment that's just along for the ride that it's already correlated with, and then we'd apply a unitary operation between the system and the environment. Okay, you can do all this in abstract index notation if you like, but it's a little bit simpler in just to go with Dirac here. So we're only interested in keeping track of the density operator of the system. So the initial density operator is the partial trace over this reference system here. After we apply the unitary, it's the partial trace of the final state. But the final state is written in terms of the initial state like this, as we did on the last slide. And here's its dagger. So what you can see is that the only thing that depends on R is this initial state. So I can bring this trace over, this partial trace over R inside, and that will just give me the initial density operator. And then I just have the unitary acting on it and then trace over the rest of the environment. Put in the trace, that just means sum with j's on the environment, and then we get a form like this, okay? So this thing here is an operator on the system and the environment, and I'm partial inner producting on both sides only over the environment. So this thing will end up being an operator on the system, okay? So I have an operator on the system, and I have its dagger here. So I'll just define that operator to be called mj. It depends on this basis vector j. And then you see that you have a sum of an operator acting on one side, its dual acting on the other side, a sum over such things. And that's called the operator sum decomposition. And these operators here are called Krauss operators. Okay. So you know that the dynamics of the system alone is going to look something like that. The Krauss operators have to satisfy another condition. I'm putting the dagger first here. Right? So I'm taking mj dagger m, and I'm summing over j. Those were defined in terms of the u's like this. You can see in the middle here, I've got a sum over j of a basis. So that's just going to become the identity operator. I can get rid of it. So I'll get u dagger u sandwiched between this. U dagger u is just the identity on the system and the environment. Now the this initial phi vector comes through and I get an inner product, which is just one. So the whole thing is just going to be the identity operator on the system. So we know that Krauss operators have to satisfy that mj dagger mj, sum over j, has to be the identity operator. Do they have to satisfy any other constraints? The answer is no. It turns out that for any set of operators, they don't have to be self-adjoint, they don't have to be positive or anything. If they satisfy this condition, then you can construct a unitary operation such that you can obtain those operators in this way, okay? So those are the only constraints on this kind of map. You should have an operator sum decomposition, and the operators have to satisfy this sum here has to be the identity. It's not particularly hard to prove that. It's just a little bit cumbersome. I have to construct big unit trees and things like that. So I will refer you to, for example, look at the Nielsen and Chang book on quantum information if you really want to see the proof. Okay. I should stop in a minute. Let me just do this slide. Actually, no, it's basically past already, so let me defer the smaller church picture till next time. Okay, that's it. Thanks.